The note was so bad, Mary concluded, and so unlike B, that it was almost deliberately bad. Good enough to fool Fergus when it was delivered to the door this afternoon. Bad enough to be a signal to Mary that it meant something different. Something she had been warned of, for instance. She had read the clues from the moment she opened the door to the vanman, while Fergus the idiot lurked in the coat cupboard with a bloody great howitzer in his hand, in case the vanman turned out to be a Russian in disguise. Which, perhaps on reflection, he was, because B had never used a private delivery service in her life. B would have dropped the book in herself on the way back from Becky's school, cooing through the letterbox. B would have buttonholed Mary at the International Ladies on Tuesday, leaving her to hump the damn thing home as best she could. "Mind if I read the card, Mary?" Fergus had said. "It's just routine. Only you know what they're like in London, B. That'll be Mrs. Lederer, wife of the American gentleman." "That's who it will be," Mary had confirmed. "Well, it's a nice book, I will say. In English, too. Looks really old, it does." He was turning through it with practiced fingers, pausing at pencil marks, holding occasional pages to the light. "It's 1698, Mary had said, pointing to the Roman numerals. "My goodness, you can read that stuff? Can I have it back now, please?" The grandfather clock in the hall was striking 12. Fergus and Georgie were by now no doubt lying blissfully in each other's arms. Over the interminable days of her secret imprisonment, Mary had watched their romance ripen. Tonight, when she came down to dinner, Georgie had the undisguisable glow of someone who had been screwing minutes before. In a year's time, the two of them would become yet another his-and-hers couple, in one of the resources sections where the other ranks held sway. Surveillance, microphone installation, sweeping, steaming mail. A year later, when they had pooled their fiddled overtime and their cooked-up mileage, and inflated their out-of-town subsistence, they would make a down payment on a house in East Sheen, have two children, and become eligible for the firm's subsidized education scheme. "I'm being a jealous bitch," thought Mary, unrepentant. "Right now I wouldn't mind an hour with Fergus myself." She picked up the receiver and waited. "Who are you ringing, Mary?" said Fergus's voice immediately. Wherever he was in his love life just then, Fergus was very awake indeed when it came to cutting in on Mary's outgoing calls. "I'm lonely," Mary replied. "I want to have a chat with B. Lederer. Anything wrong with that?"
"Magnus is still in London, Mary. He's been delayed."
"I know where he is. I know the story. I am also grown up."
"He's been contacting you regular by phone. You've had nice chats with him. He'll be back in a day or two. Head office has nabbed him for a briefing while he's over there. That's all that's happened."
"I'm all right, Fergus. I'm word perfect."
"Would you normally ring her as late as this?"
"If both Magnus and Grant are away, yes, I would."
Mary heard a click, and then the dialing tone. She dialed the number, and B started moaning at once. She was having her damned period, she said. A real bastard. Cramps, the bends, you name it. It always grabbed her this way in winter, especially when Grant wasn't there to service her. Giggle. "Oh, shit, Mary, I really miss it. Does that make me a whore?"
"I've had a lovely long letter from Tom," said Mary.
A lie. It was a letter, and it was long. But it was not lovely. It was an account of the great time Tom had had with Uncle Jack last Sunday, and it had made Mary's flesh creep.
B declared that Becky just adored Tom so much he was indecent. Can you imagine what is going to happen the day those kids wake up and discover la différence?
Yes, I can, thought Mary. They're going to hate each other's guts.
She took B through her day. "Hell, just screwing around," said B. She'd had a squash date with Kathy Crane from the Canadian Embassy, but they'd agreed on a coffee instead because of B's condition. Salad at the club. And Jesus, somebody really ought to teach those damned Austrians how to make a decent salad. This afternoon, a cruddy bring-and-buy at the embassy in aid of the Contras in Nicaragua. And who gives a fly's elbow about the Contras in Nicaragua?
"You should go out and buy yourself something," Mary suggested. "A dress or an antique or something."
"Listen, I can't even move. You know what he did, the little runt? He turned the Audi in for servicing on his way to the airport.
I don't get the car. I don't get a lay.
I'd better ring off, Mary said. I've got a feeling Magnus is going to pull one of his dead-of-night calls, and there'll be all hell if the number is engaged.
Yeah. How's he taken it?
Said B, vaguely.
Is he all weepy, or is he sort of reconciled?
Some men, I think they really want to castrate their fathers all their lives. You should hear Grant sometimes.
I'll know when he's back, said Mary.
Before he left, he hardly spoke a word.
Too cut up, huh?
Grant never gets cut up about anything, the creep.
It hit him badly at first, Mary confessed. He sounds much better now.
She had scarcely rung off before the phone gave its in-house buzz.
Why didn't you mention the beautiful book she sent you, Mary? Fergus complained. I thought that was why you'd be ringing.
I told you why I was ringing. I was ringing because I was lonely. B. Lederer sends me about 15 books a week. Why should I talk to her about a bloody book to please you?
I wasn't meaning to offend Mary.
She didn't mention the book, so why should I? She gave me all the necessary instructions in her bloody note.
I'm protesting too much, she thought, cursing herself. I'm putting questions in his mind.
Listen, Fergus, I'm tired and liable to bite, okay? Leave me alone and go back to what you both do best.
She picked up the book.
Nothing, not a book on earth, could have authenticated the sender so perfectly. De Arte Graphica, The Art of Painting by C.A. Dufresnoy, with remarks. Translated into English, together with an original preface, containing a parallel between painting and poetry, by Mr. Dryden.
She drained the glass of whiskey. It was the same book. She had no doubt. The same book Magnus brought to me in Berlin when I still belonged to Jack.
Came bounding up the stairs with it, knocking on the steel door of Special Ordnance, which was our cover, while he clutched it in his hand. Hey, Mary, open up!
It was before we had become lovers. Before he had started to call me Mabs.
Listen, I want you to do a rush job for me. Can you put a CD into the binding of this? It's to take one standard sheet of code cloth. Can you do it by tonight?
Then I staged a misunderstanding, because we were already flirting. I pretended I hadn't heard of CDs, except on diplomatic cars, which allowed Magnus to explain to me in his earnest way that CD meant concealment device. And Jack Brotherhood had told him Mary was the best person for the job.
We're using a bookshop as a dead letterbox, Magnus explained. I've got this Joe, who's an antiquarian book fiend.
Case officers were not usually so generous about their operations.
And I took off the end paper, she remembered, as she began gently prodding the covers. I scraped away a patch of coverboard until I was nearly at the hide. Other people would have taken off the hide and gone under it from the front. Not our Mary. For Magnus, nothing but perfection would do. Next night he gave me dinner. The night after that, we went to bed together. Next morning I told Jack what had happened, and he was gallant and sweet and said we were both very lucky, and that he'd withdraw from the field and let us get on with it, if that was what I wanted. I said it was. And I told Jack in my happiness that what had brought me and Magnus together was De Arte Graphica, a parallel between painting and poetry, which was rather extraordinary when you remembered that I was mad about painting, and Magnus was hell-bent on writing the great novel of his life.
Where are you going, Mary? Fergus said, looming before Mary in the corridor. She had the book in her hand. She shoved it at him.
I can't sleep. I'm going down to the cellar to fool around with this.
Now go back to your nice lady and leave me alone.
Closing the cellar door, she went quickly to the workbench. In minutes, Georgie is going to saunter in with a nice cup of tea for me in order to make sure I haven't defected or cut my wrists. Filling a bowl with warm water, Mary damped a rag and set to work soaking off the endpaper. The writer of the note knew what he was talking about. On a book of that age, the original glue was animal and would have crystallized. Mary, when she had doctored it for Magnus, had used animal glue too. But the new paper had been stuck on with flour paste, which responded quickly to water. She was using a cloth and scrubbing. Normally she would have used blotting paper and a pressing tin. The end paper came away. The board remained. Taking a scalpel, she began scuffing it with the blade. If they've used rope board, I've had it.
Rope board was made of real old rope taken from a man of war. It was tarred and twisted and packed solid. To scrape into it would take hours. She need not have worried. It was modern millboard, and disintegrated like dry earth. She kept scuffing, and suddenly the code cloth lay before her, flat against the inside of the hide, exactly where she had put it for Magnus. Except that this one had capital letters instead of figure groups. This one began, "Dear Mary." She stuffed it quickly down her front, retrieved the scalpel, and set about removing the rest of the endpaper, as if she were going to rebind it from the beginning, full hide as Bea had requested. "I just thought I had to come in and see how you do it," Georgie explained, sitting down beside her. "I really need a hobby like that myself, Mary. I just don't ever seem able to relax." "Poor you," said Mary. It was night, and Brotherhood was angry. Though he was out in the streets and away from the firm and the firm's ken, though he had work to do and action to relieve him, he was angry. His anger had been mounting for 2 days. This morning's outburst about the Joes was not the start of it. It had been kindled yesterday, like a slow-burning fuse, as he was leaving the conference room in St. John's Wood, after perjuring himself to save Bramall's neck. It had stuck with him like a faithful friend through his meeting with Tom and his excursion to Reading Station. "Pym has broken the moral laws. He has outlawed himself by choice." It had touched flashpoint in the signals room this morning, and gathered more heat with every pointless conference and frittered hour since. From his position of half-pitied and wholly blamed has-been, Brotherhood had listened to his own arguments being used against him, and had looked on as, under his very eyes, his old defence of Pym had been adopted and updated into a policy of institutionalised inertia. "But, Jack, it's all so circumstantial, you said so yourself," Bramall brayed, never stronger than when demonstrating that two positives make a negative. "If you run any succession of coincidences through a computer, you will find that everything looks possible, and most things look highly likely. Who said that, pray? I'm quoting you deliberately, Jack. We're sitting at your feet, remember? Good heavens, I never thought I'd have to defend Pym against you." "I was wrong," said Brotherhood. "But who says you were? Only you, I think." "So Pym has a check code pad in his chimney place," Bramall conceded. "He has a camera we didn't know about with a document copying attachment or whatever. Good heavens, Jack, think of all the bits of equipment you've picked up in your time. Just in the ordinary way of playing agents back and forth. Gold bars, cameras, micro-dot lenses, concealment devices, I don't know what. You could have started your own pawnbroker shop with them. All right, I grant you we should have turned the stuff in. I see him as being rather in the position of a police detective who has taken a lot of swag off one of his informants. He shoves it in a drawer or in the fireplace, hides it from his family, and one day it's all discovered. But it doesn't make him a burglar. It makes him an efficient policeman who's been cavalier, or at worst, careless." "He's not careless," said Brotherhood. "He's not a risk-taker." "All right. So now he is. The fellow's had a nervous breakdown. He's acting clean out of character. He's hidden himself away somewhere. He's putting out the usual cries for help," Bramall reasoned, in a note of saintly tolerance. "Probably a girlfriend, knowing him. We shall find out soon enough. But look at the scenario, Jack. His father dies. He's the artistic type of officer, always wanting to write the great novel, paint, sculpt, take sabbaticals, I don't know what. He's hit a menopausal age in life. He's been living under a cloud of suspicion for far too long. Do you wonder he's had a bit of a crack-up? Be a wonder if he hadn't, if you ask me. All right, I don't condone it. And I shall want to know why he took that burn box, though you tell me he knew everything that was in it anyway, and wrote most of it himself, so what's the difference? And when we find him, I may pull him out of the field for a while. There is still no justification for me to raise a public hue and cry, to go to my minister and say, 'We've found another one,' least of all to the Americans. Bang go the barter treaties. Bang goes the intelligence pooling and the private line to Langley, that often means so much more than normal diplomatic links. Do you want me to risk all that until we know?" Beaufields, you should stop flying solo, Nigel said, when they were back on the servant side of Bramble's door. I'm afraid I agree. From now on, you'll make no field inquiries without my personal authority. You're to remain on call and you're to start nothing. Is that clear? It is clear, thought Brotherhood, examining the house from across the road. It is clear that the rewards of my old age are dangerously threatened. He tried to remember who it was in mythology who was cursed to live long enough to witness the consequences of his bad advice. The house was in the best of Chelsea's many beautiful backwaters, set at the end of a long garden, only partly visible above the gate. An air of decadence pervaded its genteel shabbiness. An unworldly languor inhabited its flaking stucco. Brotherhood walked past it several times, checking the upper windows, studying the skyline for sight of a church, for Pym's mental substitutions were becoming rooted in his mind like spy talk. On the fourth floor, a dormer window was lit and curtained. As he watched, he saw a figure pass across it, too quickly and too far away for him to tell whether it was man or woman. He took a last look up and down the road. A brass bell push was set into the gatepost. He pressed it and waited, but not long. He shoved the gate. It creaked and opened. He stepped inside and closed it after him. The garden was a secret patch of English countryside, walled on three sides. Nothing overlooked it. The sounds of traffic ceased miraculously. The flagstone path was slippery with unswept leaves. Home, he rehearsed again. Home in Scotland. Home in Wales. Home by the sea. Home as an upper window and a church. Home as an aristocratic mother who took him visiting great houses. He passed the statue of a draped woman, one stone breast offered to the autumn night. Home as a series of concentric fantasies, all with the same truth at the centre. Who had said that? Pym or himself? Home as promises to women he didn't love. The front door was opening as he reached it. A young manservant was watching him approach. His monkey jacket had a regimental cut. Behind him, unrestored gilt mirrors and a chandelier glinted against dark wallpaper. He's got a boy named Stegwold living there, Superintendent Bellows of Police Liaison had reported. If you were old enough, I'd read you his record of convictions. Sir Kenneth in, son, said Brotherhood pleasantly, as he wiped his shoes on the mat and shook off his raincoat. I don't know, do I? Who shall I say? Mr. Marlowe, son. And I'd like 10 minutes with him alone on a mutual matter. From? Said the boy. His constituency, son, said Brotherhood, just as pleasantly. The boy tripped quickly upstairs. Brotherhood's gaze skimmed the hall. Hats. Idiosyncratic. Coaching overcoat, green with age. One guard's bowler, ditto. Army service cap with Coldstream badge. Blue china urn stuffed with ancient golf clubs, walking sticks and warped tennis rackets. The boy came mincing down the stairs again, trailing one hand on the banisters, unable to resist an entrance. He'll see you now, Mr. Marlowe, he said. The stairs were lined with portraits of rude men. In a dining room, two places were laid with enough silver for a banquet. A decanter, cold meats and cheeses lay on the sideboard. It was not until Brotherhood noticed a couple of dirty plates that he realized the meal was already over. The library smelled of mildew and the fumes of paraffin from a stove. A gallery ran along three walls. Half the balustrade was missing. The stove had been shoved into the fireplace, and in front of it stood a clothes horse hung with socks and underpants. In front of the clothes horse stood Sir Kenneth Sefton Boyd. He wore a velvet smoking jacket and an open-necked shirt, and old satin slippers, with gold-stitch monograms worn away. He was burly and thick-necked, with uneven pads of flesh round his jaw and eyes. His mouth was bent to one side, as if by a clenched fist. He spoke with the bent side, while the other stayed still. Marlowe. How do you do, sir? Said Brotherhood. What do you want? I'd like to speak to you alone, if I may, sir. Policeman? Not quite, sir. Something like. He handed Sir Kenneth a card. This is to certify that the bearer is engaged in inquiries affecting the national security. For confirmation, please ring Scotland Yard Extension so-and-so. The extension led to Superintendent Bellow's department, which knew all Brotherhood's names. Unimpressed, Sir Kenneth handed the card back.
So you're a spy?
Of a sort, I suppose, yes.
Want a drink, beer, scotch?
What do you want to drink? A scotch would be very welcome, sir, now you mention it.
Scotch, Steggy, said Sir Kenneth. Get him a scotch, will you? Ice? Soda? What do you want in your scotch?
A little water would be welcome.
All right, give him water. Bring him a jug. Put it on the table. Over there by the tray. Then he can help himself and you can go away. And top mine up while you're about it. Want to sit down, Marlowe? Over there, do you?
I thought we were going to the Albion, said Steggy from the door.
Can't now. Got to talk to this chap.
Brotherhood sat. Sir Kenneth sat opposite him. His gaze was yellowed and unresponsive. Brotherhood had seen dead men whose eyes were more alive. His hands had fallen into his lap, and one of them kept flipping like a beached fish. On the table between them lay a backgammon board, with the pieces in mid-battle. Who was he playing with? Thought Brotherhood. Who dined with him? Who was sharing his music with him? Who warmed my chair before I sat in it?
You surprised to see me, sir, said Brotherhood.
Take a bit more than that to surprise me, old boy.
Anyone else been here recently, making funny inquiries? Foreign gentlemen? Americans?
Not that I know of. Why should they?
There's a bunch going round from our own vetting side as well, I'm told. I wondered whether any of them had been here. I tried to find out before I left the office, but there's a lack of coordination. It's all moving so fast.
What is?
Well, sir, it seems that your old school friend, Mr. Magnus Pym, has disappeared. They're looking into everyone who might have knowledge of his whereabouts. That will include you, naturally. Sir Kenneth's eye lifted to the door.
Something out there bothering you, sir, said Brotherhood.
Sir Kenneth rose, went to the door, and pulled it open. Brotherhood heard a scuffle of footsteps on the stairs, but he was too late to see who it was, though he jostled Sir Kenneth aside in his haste to look.
Steggy, I want you to go to the Albion ahead of me,
Sir Kenneth called into the well.
Go now, I'll join you later.
I don't want him hearing this stuff, he told Brotherhood as he closed the door. And what he doesn't know can't hurt him.
With his record, I don't blame you, said Brotherhood.
Mind if I look upstairs now we're standing?
Yes, I damn well do. And don't lay hands on me again. I don't fancy you. Got a warrant?
No.
Resuming his chair, Sir Kenneth took a spent matchstick from the pocket of his smoking jacket and set to work on his fingernails with its charred end.
Get a warrant, he advised. Get a warrant and I might let you look. Other hand, I mightn't.
Is he here? Said Brotherhood.
Who?
Pym.
Dunno. Didn't hear. Who's Pym?
Brotherhood was still standing. He was unnaturally pale, and it took him a moment to steady his voice before he spoke again.
I've got a deal for you, he said.
Sir Kenneth still did not hear.
Hand him over to me. You go upstairs, or you ring him. You do whatever you've agreed to do between you, and you hand him over to me. In return, I'll keep your name out of it, and Steggy's name out of it. The alternative is, Baronet MP Shelter's very old friend on the run. It's also a serious possibility that you will be charged as an accomplice.
How old is Steggy?
Old enough.
How old was he when he started here?
Look it up, don't know. I'm Pym's friend, too. There are worse people than me coming looking for him. Ask him. If he agrees, I agree. I'll keep your name out of it. Just give him to me, and you and Steggy need never hear from him or me again.
Well, sounds to me as though you've more to lose than we have, said Sir Kenneth,
surveying the results of his manicure.
I doubt it.
A question of what we've all got left, I suppose. Can't lose what you haven't got. Can't miss what you don't care about. Can't sell what isn't yours.
Pym can, apparently, said Brotherhood. He's been selling his nation's secrets by the look of it.
Sir Kenneth continued to admire his fingernails.
For money?
Probably. Sir Kenneth shook his head.
Didn't care about money. Love was all he cared about. Didn't know where to find it. Clown, really. Tried too hard.
Meanwhile, he's wandering around England with a lot of papers that aren't his to give away, and you and I are supposed to be patriotic Englishmen. A lot of chaps do a lot of things they shouldn't do. That's when they need their chums. He wrote to his son about you. Do you know that? Some drivel about a penknife. Does that ring a bell?
Matter of fact, it does.
Who's Poppy?
Never heard of her.
Or him?
Nice thought, but no.
Wentworth.
Never been there. Hate the place. What about it?
There was a girl called Sabina he apparently got caught up with in Austria. He ever mention her?
Not that I remember. Pym got caught up with a lot of girls. Not that it did him much good.
He rang you, didn't he? On Monday night from a call box. With startling abruptness, Sir Kenneth flung up one arm in pleasure and gave a hoot of merriment.
Pissed out of his skull, he declared, very loud. Ossified. Haven't heard him so pissed since Oxford, when six of us put away a case of his father's port. Pretended some queen from Merton gave it to him. Don't know why. There weren't any queens in Merton in those days. Not rich ones. We were all at Trinity.
It was after midnight. Back in the confinement of his Shepherd Market flat with the pigeons on the parapet, Brotherhood poured himself another vodka and added orange juice from a carton. He had thrown his jacket on the bed. His pocket tape recorder lay before him on the desk. He was jotting as he listened.
Don't go to Wiltshire a lot as a rule, while Parliament's in session. But Sunday was my second wife's birthday, and our boy was down from school. So I went and did my stuff, and I thought I'd stay on for a day or two, and see what gives in the constituency.
Forward again.
Don't normally answer the phone in Wiltshire, but Monday's her bridge night, and I was in the library playing a game of backgammon. So when the phone rang, I thought I might as well take it rather than spoil her four. 11:30 it might have been. But Jean's bridge nights go on forever. Chap's voice. Must be her boyfriend, I thought. Bloody cheek, really, this time of night. Hello, Seth. That's Seth? Who the hell's that, I said. It's me, Magnus. My father's died. Over here to bury him. I thought, poor old chap. Nobody likes to have his old man die on him. Is that right for you? More water? Help yourself.
Brotherhood hears himself roar thanks as he leans towards the water jug. Then the sounds of a flood as he pours.
How's Jem? He says. Jemima's my sister. They had a ding-dong once. Never came to much. Married a florist. Extraordinary thing. Chap grows flowers all along the road to Basingstoke. Puts his name up on a board. Doesn't seem to bother her. Not that she sees much of him. Navigational problems, our Jem. Same as me.
Forward again.
Pissed. Couldn't tell whether he was laughing or crying. Poor chap, I thought. Drowning his sorrows. I'd do the same. Next thing I know, he's prosing on about our private school. I mean, Christ, we'd done two or three schools together. Oxford? Not to mention a couple of holidays. Yet all he wants to talk about 40 years later on the blower, middle of the night, party going on, is how he carved my initials in the staff loo at our private and got me flogged for it. Sorry I carved your initials, Seth. All right. He did it. He carved them. I never doubted he carved them. Cocked it up, too. He would. Know what he did? Bloody fool put a hyphen between the S and the B where we don't have one. I told old Grimble, the headmaster. Why would I put a hyphen in it? Look at the school list. Not a blind bit of difference. Flogged me. Way it goes, you see. No justice. I don't know I minded much. Everybody flogged everybody in those days. Besides, I wasn't very nice to him myself. Always ragging him about his people. Father was a con man, you know. Nearly ruined my aunt. Had a go at my mother, too. Tried to bed her, but she was too fly. Some scheme to build a new airport in Scotland somewhere. He'd squared the locals. All he needed was buy the land, get the formal permission, make fortune. Cousin of mine owns half Argyle. I asked him about it. Hokum, the whole thing.
Extraordinary. I stayed with them once. Tart's Parlour in Ascot. All these crooks hanging about and Magnus calling them sir. Father tried to get into Parliament once. Pity he didn't. He'd have been good company.
Forward again.
Banging in the cash. I asked him where he was. He said London, but he had to use phone boxes. He was being followed. I said, whose initials have you been carving now? Joke, actually, but he didn't see it. I was sorry about his old man, you see. Didn't want him moping. Dramatic chap. Always has been. Nothing going on in his life unless he's got some frightful problem on his hands. You could have sold him the Egyptian pyramids, long as you said they were falling down. I said, give me the number of your phone, I'll ring you back. He said somebody must have told me to say that. I said, absolute bilge, hell are you talking about? Half my friends are on the run. He said his father was dead, and he was looking at his life for the first time. Fundamental, always has been. Then he went back to these initials he'd carved. I'm really sorry, Seth. I said, look here, old boy, I always knew it was you, and I don't think we should go through life wearing hair shirts about what we did at our private. Do you need cash? Want a bed? Pick a cottage on the estate. I'm really sorry, Seth, really sorry. I said, you tell me what I can do, I'll do it. I'm in the book in London. Give me a buzz if I can help. Well, I mean, damn it, he'd been on for 20 minutes. I put the phone down, and half an hour later he's back. Hello, Seth, me again. Jean was pretty shirty this time. Thought it was Steggy having a tantrum. Got to talk to you, Seth, listen to me. Well, you can't ring off on an old chum when he's down, can you?
Brotherhood heard Sir Kenneth's clock chime 12. He was jotting fast. Concentric fantasies, he repeated to himself, defining the truth at the centre. He had reached the passage he was waiting for.
Said he was in secret work. That didn't surprise me. Who isn't these days? Said there was this Englishman he worked for. Called him the Brotherhood. I don't think I listened to all of it, to be honest. There was the Brotherhood and there was this other chap. Said he was working for both of them. They were like two parents for him. Kept him going. I said, bully for you. If they keep you going, you stick to them. Said he had to write this book about them, put the record right. What record? God knows. He'd write to the Brotherhood, write to the other chap. Then he'd take himself off to a secret place and do his number.
Brotherhood heard his own patient murmur in the background.
Well, maybe I got that one a bit wrong, then. Maybe he was going to hunker down in his secret place first and write to both of them from there. I wasn't listening to all of it. Drunks bore me. I'm one myself.
Prompt from Brotherhood. Long pause. Renewed prompt from Brotherhood. Sir Kenneth, indistinct.
Said he was his runner.
Who was whose runner?
Pym was t'other chap's runner, not the Brotherhood's, the other fellow's. Said he'd crippled him somehow. Pissed, I told you.
Brotherhood again, riding him a little harder. Name for this person?
Don't think so. Don't think it stuck. Sorry. No, it didn't.
And the secret place, where was that?
Didn't say. His business.
Brotherhood let the tape continue. Avalanche, as Sefton Boyd lights himself a cigarette. Cannon blast of the front door being slammed open and shut again, signalling Steggy's petulant return. Brotherhood and Sir Kenneth are on the landing.
What's that, old boy?
Sir Kenneth, very loud.
I said, sir, where do you think he might be?
Says Brotherhood.
Upstairs, old boy. That's what you said.
In his memory's eye, Brotherhood sees Sir Kenneth's pouchy face approach close to his own, smiling its downward twist.
Get a warrant? Maybe you can have a look. Maybe you can't. Don't know. Have to see.
Brotherhood heard his own heels clumping down Sir Kenneth's stairs. He heard himself reach the hall, and Steggy's lighter footsteps mingle with his own. He heard Steggy's pointed good night, and the clatter of bolts as he unlocks the door for him, followed by Steggy's muffled shriek as Brotherhood hauls him out of the house, one hand over his mouth, the other at the back of his head. Then the thump as he taps Steggy's head against the plaster pillar of Sir Kenneth's gracious porch, and his own voice, very near to Steggy's ear.
"Have they done this before to you? Have they? Put you up against a wall?"
A whimper for an answer.
"Who else is living in the house, son?"
"No one."
"Who was on the top floor this evening, back and forth in front of the window?"
"Me."
"Why?"
"It's my room."
"I thought you two would share the bridal chamber."
"I've still got my own room, haven't I? I'm entitled to my privacy, same as he is."
"Nobody else in the house at all?"
"No."
"Not all week?"
"No. I told you. Hey, stop!"
"What's the matter?" says Brotherhood, already halfway down the path.
"I haven't got my key. How do I get back in?"
A clang as Brotherhood slams the gate.
He phoned Kate. No answer. He phoned his wife. No answer.
He phoned Paddington and wrote down the times and places along the route of the sleeper from Paddington to Penzance via Reading. For an hour he tried to sleep, then returned to his desk, pulled Langley's folder towards him, and stared yet again at the eaten-out features of Herr Petz Hampel Zaworski, Pym's presumed controller, lately of Corfu, real name unknown, query member Czech archaeological team, visiting Egypt 1961, Petz. Query 1966, attached Czech military mission, East Berlin, Hampel, height 6 foot, stoops, limps slightly with left leg.
"There was the Brotherhood and there was this other chap," Sefton Boyd had said. "They were like two parents for him. Said he was his runner."
"You brought it on yourselves," he heard Belinda say. "You invented him."
He continued to stare at the photograph, the downturned eyelids, the downturned moustache, the twinkly eyes, the hidden Slav smile. "Who the devil are you? Why do I recognize you when I have never set eyes on you?"
Grant Lederer had never stood so high in the world, or felt so rounded as a human being.
"Justice lives," he assured himself, in the perfect peacefulness of his triumph.
"My masters are worthy of their authority. A noble service has tried me to the limit and found me worthy of my hire." All round him, the sealed operations room on the 6th floor of the American Embassy in Grosvenor Square was filling up with people he had not known existed. They came from the remote corners of London Station, yet each, as he entered, appeared to bestow a glance of kinship on him. "As final-looking bunch of Americans as you'd wish to meet," he thought. "The agency really knows how to pick us these days." They had hardly settled before Wexler began speaking.
"Time to wrap this thing up," he said grimly, as the door was locked. "Meet Gary, everybody. Gary's head of CISERP. He's here to report an important breakthrough on Pym and discuss action."
CISERP, Lederer had recently learned, was the acronym for Surveillance Intelligence Southern Europe. Gary was your typical Kentuckian, tall, spare, and amusing. Lederer already admired him intensely. An aide sat at his elbow with a heap of papers, but Gary did not refer to them. "Our quarry," he said baldly, "was Petz Hampel Zaworski, now known to the indoctrinated familiarly as PHZ. A CISERP team picked him up Tuesday 10:12 a.m., emerging from the Czech embassy in Vienna." Lederer listened enthralled as Gary noted each tiny detail of PHZ's day. Where PHZ took his coffee, where PHZ took his leaks, the bookshops where PHZ browsed, whom PHZ lunched with, where, what he ate, PHZ's limp, his ready smile, his charm, particularly with women, his cigars, where he lit them, bought them, PHZ's ease of association, his apparent unawareness that he was being observed by a field force 18 strong. The two occasions when, wittingly or otherwise, PHZ placed himself in the vicinity of Mrs. Mary Pym. "On one of these occasions," said Gary, "eye contact was confirmed. On the other, surveillance was inhibited by the presence of a British pair believed to be the escorts of Mrs. Pym." And thence at last to the crowning moment of the operation, and the high point of Grant Lederer's brilliant marriage and dazzling career so far, when at 8 a.m. local time today,
three members of Gary's team found themselves stuck in the rear pews of the English church in Vienna, while 12 more were staked out around the outside of it. Mobile units, necessarily, because this was diplomatic land, where loiterers were not well regarded, and PHZ and Mary Pym were placed either side of the aisle. Lederer's cue had arrived. Gary was looking expectantly towards him.
"Grant, I guess you should take over here. We're a little out of our depth," he said, with pleasing gruffness.
As heads at the table shifted in curiosity, Lederer felt the warmth of their interest bear him to new heights. He began speaking at once, modestly. "Well, hell, I mean, I see this whole thing as B's achievement, and not mine. B is Mrs. Lederer," he explained to an older man across the table from him, then realized too late that it was Carver, head of London Station, never a Lederer fan. "She's Presbyterian. Her parents were Presbyterian too. Mrs. Lederer, latterly, has been able to reconcile her spirituality with organized religion, and has been attending regularly at the Christchurch Anglican Church, Vienna, known as the English Church. And frankly, just the sexiest little church you ever saw. Right, Gary? Cherubs, angels? More like a religious boudoir than a regular church at all. You know, Mick, if anybody's name is going up in lights at Langley over this, I guess it should be B's," he added, still somehow not quite able to get to his story. The rest came out faster. It was B, after all, and not the surveillance team who had managed to slide out into the aisle after PHZ and stand in line right behind him as he and Mary queued for the sacrament. It was B, who from a distance of maybe 5 feet had watched as PHZ leaned forward and whispered real words into Mary's ear, and watched again as Mary first leaned back to catch them, then went ahead with her devotions, as if nothing in the world had happened. "So I mean it was actually my wife, my helpmate throughout all of this long operation, who witnessed the spoken contact." He shook his head in marvel. "And it was B again, who, the first moment the service ended, raced back to our apartment to phone me right here at the embassy, and described the whole amazing occurrence, using the domestic code words the two of us had hashed out together for just such a contingency. And I mean, B did not even know that an agency surveillance team was present in that church at all. She just went because Mary was going, as much as anything. Yet she scooped Sisherp single-handed by like 6 hours, more." "Harry," said Lederer, a little breathlessly, finding Wexler as he put the finishing touch to his narrative, "my only regret is that Mrs. Lederer never learned to lip-read." Lederer had not expected applause. It was in the nature of the community he had joined that there should be none. The pregnant silence struck him as a more fitting tribute. Artelli, the cryptographer, was the first to break it.
"Here at the embassy?" he repeated, not quite as a question.
"Pardon me?" said Lederer.
"Your wife called you here at the embassy, from Vienna, directly after the happening in the church, on the open phone from your apartment?"
"Yes, sir. I took her news straight upstairs to Mr. Wexler. He had it on his desk by 9 a.m.
9:30, Wexler said. "And what were these domestic code words that she used, please?" said Artelli, while he wrote.
Lederer was happy to explain. "Well, really, what we did, in fact, was borrow the names of B's aunts and uncles. We have always considered there was a similarity in the psychological profiles of Mary Pym and B's Aunt Edie. So we kind of worked it up from there. You know what Aunt Edie did in church today. B is very subtle."
"Thanks," said Artelli.
Next, Carver spoke, and his question did not seem entirely friendly. "You mean your wife is conscious to this operation, Grant? I thought the Pym case was strictly a no-wives thing. Harry, didn't we make a ruling on that a little while back?"
"Strictly, it is no-wives," Lederer agreed handsomely.
"However, since Mrs. Lederer has effectively been out in the field with me on this one, it would be somewhat illusory to suppose you would not be aware of the general level of suspicion in relation to the Pyms.
Well, to Magnus, anyway. And I may add that it was always B's contention that somewhere at the bottom of this heap, we were going to find Mary playing a very deep and laid-back role. Mary is a role-player."
Carver again. "Is Mrs. Lederer also conscious to PHZ?"
He's a pretty hot addition to the cast, Grant. He could be a big fish. But she's in on that, huh? There was nothing Lederer could do to stop the colour rushing to his face, or his voice developing its strident edge. Mrs. Lederer had an instinct regarding that encounter, and she acted on it. You want to censure her for that, Carver? You censure me first, okay? Artelli again, with his damned French drawl. What was your domestic code name for PHZ? Uncle Bobby, Lederer snapped. But then Bobby is more than instinct, Grant, Carver objected. Bobby is an agreed thing between you. How could you have agreed Bobby if you hadn't given her the story on Petz Hempel Zaworski? Wexler had taken back the meeting.
Okay, 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 he growled unhappily. Cope with that later. Meantime, what do we do? Sissup splits and stays with the both of them. PHZ and Mary. That right, Gary? Wherever they go.
I'm calling for fresh horses right now, said Gary. Should have two full teams by this time tomorrow.
Next question. What the hell do we tell the Brits, and when and how? Said Wexler.
Looks like we told them already, said Artelli, with a lazy glance at Lederer.
That's unless the Brits have given up tapping U.S. embassy telephone lines these days, which I tend to doubt.
Justice lives, but justice, as Grant Lederer discovered before morning, also dies. His health was found to have suffered a sudden lapse. His appointment in Vienna terminated for him in his absence. His wife, far from receiving the commendations Lederer dreamed of, was ordered to follow him back to Langley, Virginia, at once. Lederer overheats and overrelates, wrote one of the agency's ever-expanding team of house psychiatrists. He requires a less hysterical environment. The prescribed calm was eventually found for him in statistics, and it drove him nearly mad.
Chapter 13. The green cabinet stood in the centre of Pym's room like a discarded field piece that had once been its regiment's pride. Its chrome was peeling from the handles. A heavy boot or fall had stove in one corner, so that the slightest touch could set it trembling and worrying. The chips had rusted into sores. The rust had spread to the screw holes and underneath the paintwork, causing it to lift in humiliating pimples. Pym walked round it with the awe and loathing of a primitive. It has arrived from heaven. It is destined to return there. I should have put it in the incinerator with him so that he can show it to his maker as he intended. Four dense drawers of innocence, the gospel according to St. Rick. You are mine. You are defeated. The record has been passed to me. I have the key to prove it on my chain.
He gave the cabinet a push and heard a sagging sound from inside as the files slipped obediently to his command.
I should write you witches along his path, Tom. The full moon should be turning red, and the owl doing whatever the owl did that was so unnatural when foul murder was afoot. But Pym is deaf and blind to them. He is Second Lieutenant Magnus Pym, riding in his private train across occupied Austria, entering by way of that very border town, where long ago, in the less mature existence of a different Pym, E. Weber's fictitious crock of gold had supposedly awaited Mr. Lepardi's collection. He is a Roman conqueror on his way to taking up his first appointment. He is oven-fired against human frailty and his own destiny, as you may observe from the scowls of military abstinence he bestows upon the bare breasts of the barbarian peasant women harvesting corn in the sunlit fields. His preparation has passed with the ease of an English Sunday, not that Pym ever asked for ease. The privileged English assets of good manners and bad learning have never been more to his advantage. Even his murky political affiliations at Oxford have turned out to be a blessing. If the Pongos ask you whether you now or ever have been a member of the clan, look 'em slap in the eye and tell 'em never, the last of the Michaels advised him, over a sporting lunch beside the swimming pool at Lansdowne, as they watched the pure bodies of suburban girls wriggle through the disinfected water.
Pongos, said Pym, mystified.
Licentious soldiery, old boy. The War Office. Wood, from here up. The firm is fixing your clearance direct. Tell them to mind their damn business.
Thanks terribly, said Pym. The same evening, glowing from the best of 9 games of squash, Pym was led to the presence of a very senior member of the service, in a plain, forgettable office, not far from Rick's newest Reichskanzlei. Was this the Colonel Gaunt who had first approached him? "He's higher," Pym was told. "Don't ask."
"We want to thank you," said the senior member.
"I really enjoyed it," said Pym.
"It's a filthy job mixing with those people. Somebody has to do it."
"Oh, it's not that bad, sir.
Look here, we're leaving your name on the books. I can't promise you anything. We've got a selection board these days. Besides, you belong to those chaps across the park, and we make it a rule not to fish in one another's preserves. All the same, if you ever do decide that protecting your country at home is more to your liking than playing Mata Hari abroad, let us know."
"I will, sir." "Thank you," said Pym. The very senior member was crisp and brown and ostentatiously nondescript, like one of his own envelopes. He had the testy manners of a country solicitor, which was what he had been before answering the great call. Leaning across his desk, he pulled a puzzled smile.
"Don't tell me if you don't want.
However did you get mixed up with that crowd in the first place?"
"The communists?
No, no, no. Our sister service. In Bern, sir. I was a student there."
"In Switzerland," said the great man, consulting a mental map.
"Yes, sir.
My wife and I went skiing near Bern once. Little place called Muren. The British run it, so there aren't any cars. We'd rather liked it. What did you do for them?"
"Much the same as for you, sir, really. It was just a bit more dangerous."
"In what way?"
"You don't feel you have the protection out there. It's eyeball to eyeball, I suppose."
"Seems such a peaceful spot to me."
"Well, good luck to you, Pym. Look out for those chaps. They're good, but they're slippery. We're good, but we've got a bit of honour left. That's the difference."
"He's brilliant," Pym told his guide.
"He pretends to be completely ordinary, but he sees right into you."
His elation had not left him when, a few days later, he presented himself, suitcase in hand, at the guardroom of his basic training regiment, where for 2 months he reaped the plentiful rewards of his upbringing. While Welsh miners and Glaswegian cutthroats wept unashamedly for their mothers, went absent without leave, and were carted off to a place of punishment, Pym slept soundly and wept for no one. Long before Revalli had dragged his comrades smoking and cursing from their beds, he had polished his boots and belt brasses and cap badge, made his bed, and dressed his bedside locker, and was all ready, should anybody ask it of him, to take a cold shower, dress again, and read the first of the day hours with Mr. Willow before a disgusting breakfast. On the parade ground and the football ground, he excelled. He neither took fright at being shouted at, nor expected logic of authority.
"Where's Gunner Pym?"
the colonel barked one day, in the middle of a lecture on the Battle of Corunna, and looked up angrily as if someone else had spoken. Every sergeant in the drill hall screamed Pym's name until he stood.
"Are you Pym?"
"Sir."
"See me after this lecture."
"Sir." Company headquarters lay on the other side of the parade ground. Pym marched there and saluted. The colonel's aide-de-camp left the room.
"At ease, Pym. Sit down."
The colonel spoke carefully, with the soldier's mistrust of words. He had a soft, honey-coloured moustache, and the limpid gaze of an entirely stupid man.
"It has been put to me by certain people that, assuming you are commissioned, you would do well to attend a certain training course at a certain establishment, Pym."
"Yes, sir."
"I am therefore to submit a personal report on you."
"Yes, sir."
"Which I shall do. Favourable, as a matter of fact."
"Thank you, sir."
"You are keen, you are not cynical. You are not marred, Pym, by the luxuries of peace. You are somebody this country needs."
"Thank you, sir." "Pym?"
"Yes, sir."
"If ever those people you're mixed up with happen to be looking for a rather fit, retired army colonel with a certain amount of je ne sais quoi, I trust you to remember me. I speak some French, I ride decently, I know my wines. Tell them that."
"I shall, sir. Thank you, sir." Possessing little in the way of memory, the colonel had a habit of returning to conversations as if they were new to him.
"Pym?"
"Yes, sir."
"Pick your moment. Don't rush in with it. They don't like that. Be subtle. That's an order."
"I will, sir."
"You know my name?"
"Yes, sir."
"Spell it."
Pym did.
I'll change it if they want. They've only to let me know. I hear you took a first, Pym.
Yes, sir.
Carry on.
In the evenings, seated beside lonely men, Pym the ever-willing obliged by dictating letters of love to their girlfriends. Where the physical feat of writing eluded them, he acted as their amanuensis, adding personalized endearments to their specification. Sometimes fired by his own rhetoric, he would burst into song on his own account, in the lyrical style of a Blunden or a Sassoon. Dearest Belinda, I cannot tell you what fun and simple human goodness are to be found among one's working-class comrades. Yesterday, great excitement, we drove our 25-pounders to a remote firing range somewhere in England for our first shoot, embussing before dawn and not reaching the RV till 11. The slatted seats of a 1,500-weight are designed to split the spine in several places. We had no cushions and only iron rations to munch. Yet the chaps whistled and sang in tremendous spirits all the way, acquitted themselves superbly, and endured the journey back with only the most cheerful grumbles. I felt privileged to be one of them, and am seriously considering refusing a commission. When a commission came his way, however, Pym contrived without difficulty to accept it, as witnessed the erogenous hillocks of khaki thread backed on green cloth, one to each shoulder of his battle dress, whose existence he covertly confirms whenever the train enters another tunnel. The bare breasts of the peasant girls are his first since the election. With each new valley, he strains his disapproving gaze to see more of them, and is seldom disappointed. "We'll send you to Vienna first," his commanding officer at the intelligence depot had said. "Chance to get the feel of the place before you're pushed out into the field."
"It sounds ideal, sir," said Pym.
Austria in those days was a different country from the one we have come to love, Tom, and Vienna was a divided city like Berlin, or your father. A few years later, to everyone's lasting amazement, the diplomats agreed they wouldn't bother with a sideshow while there was Germany to squabble over. So the occupying powers signed a treaty and went home, thus notching up the British Foreign Office's one positive achievement in my lifetime. But in Pym's day, the sideshow was going great guns. The Americans had Salzburg and Linz as their capitals, the French Innsbruck, and the Brits Graz and Klagenfurt. And everyone had a piece of Vienna to play with the inner city under joint quadripartite control. At Christmas time, the Russians gave us wooden buckets of caviar, and we gave the Russians plum puddings. And there was a story still going the rounds when Pym arrived, that when the caviar was served to the men as a prelude to their dinner, a corporal of Argyle's complained to the duty officer that the jam tasted of fish. The brains of British Vienna was a sprawling villa called Div Int, and that was where Second Lieutenant Pym was launched upon his duties, which consisted of reading reports on the movements of everything from Soviet mobile laundries to Hungarian horse cavalry, and pushing coloured pins into maps. His most exciting map showed the Soviet zone of Austria, which began a mere 20 minutes' drive from where he worked. Pym had only to look at its borders to feel intrigue and danger prickle on his skin. At other times, when he was tired or forgot himself, his eye would lift to the western tip of Czechoslovakia, to Karlovy Vary, formerly Karlsbad, the charming 18th-century spa, once favoured by Brahms and Beethoven. But he knew of no personal connection with the place, and his interest was purely historical. He lived an odd life those first months, for his destiny did not lie in Vienna. And it seems to me in fanciful moments now that the capital was itself waiting to release him to the sterner laws of nature. Too lowly to be taken seriously by his brother officers, prevented by protocol from mixing with the other ranks, too poor to revel in the swagmen's restaurants and nightclubs, Pym floated between his commandeered hotel room and his maps, much as he had floated round Bern in the days of his illegality. And I will admit now, but never then, that more than once, listening to the Viennese chattering their zany German on the pavements, or taking himself to one of the struggling small theatres that were cropping up in cellars and bombed houses, he had a pang of nostalgic longing to turn his head and discover a good friend limping at his side. But he knew of none.